Welcome to the Disrupt Yourself podcast. I'm Whitney Johnson. I'm an author, a speaker, and I write frequently about disruption for LinkedIn and the Harvard Business Review. In my book, Disrupt Yourself, I set forth a framework for putting disruptive innovation to work. Because I can't get enough of these ideas, I am continually on the hunt for people who are living disruption out loud. My guest is Susan Cain. She's the author of the best-selling book, Quiet: The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. The book is full of ideas that have disrupted the way the world thinks about introverts. She now leads the Quiet Revolution, a community of people and a consulting business that helps companies and schools rethink what they do and how they do it. She's reimagining leadership and creating environments that are productive for introverts and extroverts and everyone in between. Susan's thoughts on disruption help us see her as a writer who pushes her readers into new and potentially uncomfortable places. Her next book, which she's currently researching, aims to do just that. She's also created a personality test that gives you a chance to see where you fall on the scale of introvert to extrovert. I took it before this interview so I could surprise her with the results. Finally, in this episode, there's a new speed round of questions that both Susan and I answer to close the episode. What is the most disruptive thing you did when you were growing up?
I don't know, but you know, it's funny. I think I've always been someone who followed my own drummer, probably more than your average person. And in fact, I was just taking Gretchen Rubin's quiz that helps you figure out what kind of habit follower you are. And I discovered from that that I'm what she calls a rebel, which is like, I'm not going to do it just because you told me to do it. I'm going to have my own internal reason for doing this thing.
So you're a disruptor.
I guess so. I never really thought of it like that. And I don't know, that language is probably not what I would use. It's more like following my own path, you know? And so I knew from a very early age I wanted to be a writer, you know, and I was always creating magazines and selling subscriptions to my family members and things like that. And it didn't really matter to me that other people weren't doing that same thing. That was just my thing.
Okay. So so from a young age, one of the ways I describe disruption is this willingness to play where no one else is playing.
Yeah.
Where no one has thought of playing.
Yeah.
Because you're making a market. And so it sounds like as a young child, you were willing to do things that other people weren't necessarily doing.
Oh yeah, very much so. And I wanted to be a writer from the time I was four. So
really?
I don't even know really where I got that idea from at such a young age. I guess because I loved books so much. So I wanted, you know, if there's something you love doing, you want to then be the creator of that thing.
Absolutely. And you knew you wanted to be a writer. What kind of writer did you know you wanted to be?
Oh, well, when I was a kid, I thought I wanted to write stories because that's what you read when you're a kid, you know. I actually think part of the reason that it took me so long to actually become a writer is I didn't understand until a much later age that there was such a thing as creative nonfiction. And I'm actually not really a fiction writer by nature. So, you know, I reached a point at around age 20 or something of thinking, oh, I guess that was really just a youthful dream. And that wasn't right because I didn't really want to be writing fiction.
It was directionally right.
It was directionally right, but it took me another 10 years to figure that out.
Speaking of the next 10 years to figure it out, you have had this really big idea, a revolutionary idea, and over 2 million copies of your book have been sold, although it might be higher now. Is it higher than 2 million?
I think it probably is. I kind of forget to keep track.
Okay, but it's at least 2 million.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
I was thinking that I could recap what your idea is, but I think it would be so much better for you to tell us in a very simple way, even maybe something that a 10-year-old could understand, like, what is your big idea?
Yeah, I mean, so the idea is that one out of every two or three human beings is introverted, that there is a tremendous power associated with having this temperament, and that we live in a culture that is telling introverts that they should turn into extroverts instead of helping them to capitalize on their powers for the benefit of themselves and of everyone.
How do you define introvert?
Well, you know, probably a lot of your listeners have heard of the idea of introverts getting their energy from being in a quieter setting. So you could be very socially skilled, but you know, if you're out at the dinner party for too long, you just start to feel like, oh my God, I've got to go home. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so that is as good a working definition as anything else. But I think it's useful to know also that that comes from a neurobiological difference between introverts and extroverts.
Oh,
yeah.
Tell us. We want to hear.
Yeah. I mean, so we really are wired differently. Introverts have nervous systems that react more to stimulation. So what that means is we tend to be in our sweet spots when things are a little bit quieter around us. And when things get too chaotic or, you know, too many people, just too much going on, we start to get that kind of jangled or overwhelmed feeling, like, I want to tone this down. And extroverts have the opposite makeup. They have nervous systems that react less to stimulation. And so that means that they're at their best when there is more happening. And for them, the liability is that there's not enough going on. And then they start to feel kind of listless and sluggish and unhappy.
All right. So the Myers-Briggs definition is helpful, but it's really helpful as a starting point. And you're saying now the brain science really explains what's happening.
Yep, absolutely.
That's super helpful. So how did you come up with this idea?
Well, I've really been thinking about this all my life. You know, I have observed from the time I was a very little kid that my preferred way of spending my time was not necessarily conforming to the way our larger social structures were saying you were supposed to be, you know. So like, and I see this now with my kids, you know, you go to summer camp, for example, and, you know, you get on the bus in the morning and it's this uproarious environment and you get to camp and it's like really loud music and, hey, we're going to have so much fun today and we're going to go to this activity and this one and then this one. And you don't have any time or autonomy really to do your own thing. And it's just like, wow, I mean, that's a really interesting culture. It doesn't necessarily have to be that way, but that's the way it is. So I've been thinking about this always. When I stopped practicing law when I was in my early 30s, I started writing. And for a while, I didn't come to this topic. I wrote plays and memoirs and stories and all different stuff. And then somehow I came back to this idea that I've been thinking about all my life. And this was the one I knew I was going to try to publish. All the other stuff that I'd been working on is still sitting in my hard drive to this day, completely unattended to.
So it was warming up or kind of circling around. Yeah. Do you think you were you not aware of it or were you afraid of it?
A little bit of both. The part of being afraid of it was, you know, it was an uncomfortable subject to be talking about at the beginning because, you know, now everyone's talking about it. But back then it was like a really weird idiosyncratic topic. And so I felt a little uncomfortable bringing it up. And also there is a kind of funny byproduct of all this that now everybody is always viewing me through the lens of like, here comes the introvert, you know, and that's a strange lens to always be viewed through. And I think
it's the downside of the power of your brand, isn't it?
I guess so. Yeah.
Because you have a really, I mean, if you say Susan Cain, introversion.
Right. Right.
So that's good from a market, from Susan Cain as a product. That's really good.
Mm-hmm.
Susan Cain as a person, you're saying it can get complicated.
Yeah. It's limiting. And I don't tend to think of life in product terms. I think much more in person terms. Mm-hmm. So that's just a funny thing. You know, now having said that, I wouldn't really sit around and complain about it. It's all good.
Right.
Like everything's
right.
been
of
fantastic.
Course. Of course.
But I think I probably had some kind of inkling of that from the very beginning of doing this project. But, you know, I will say also as a writer, I've always been drawn to writing about the things that make me or people in general feel uncomfortable. Like that's always where the impulse to write has been. And in fact, I'm working on another book right now. And I can't talk about the topic.
I know you can't.
But it's the same feeling of like, oh, this is one of those topics that I think kind of bothers a lot of people and they don't even know it, sort of. And that just happens to be my muse as a writer. And it happens to come with some discomfort and you just kind of take that as part of the package.
When you had this idea and you said it was sort of awkward to broach it with people, can you think of a conversation that you had where you said, I'm thinking about doing this, and people kind of looked at you like, what?
with the introversion topic. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, even to this day, I guess a little less so now, but I would say it breaks down into a few different camps. So there are some people who are like, oh my God, you're talking about me, or oh my God, you're talking about my son or daughter, or, you know, colleague. This is amazing. And then there's another group who don't get it at first, but once they hear it, they're like, oh, okay. Yeah, mm-hmm. that makes a lot of sense. And then I think there's another group that's just totally mystified mm-hmm. by the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Some of them are extroverts, not necessarily, mm-hmm. but just, yeah. And it's a funny thing, you know, during the years before the book came out, so I would just talk about it sort of socially with friends, like, hey, what are you doing? I'm writing this book. My husband, who is much more extroverted and just kind of a natural, not exactly a sales guy, but he's just really great at presenting things. So I would listen to him talk about my book and be like, wow, that sounds like an amazing book. But it was harder for me to present it in that same way.
Interesting. Yeah. Is there any way in which you would argue that introverts are uniquely suited to disruption?
Well, I do think that it's very common for introverts to describe themselves in the way that I did, of marching to their own drummer. And, you know, whether that is some intrinsic property of being introverted, or whether it's just a byproduct from of spending quite a bit of time in your own company, either way, the result is that you kind of know what you think and feel about things, and you tend to develop your own view of the world. And I think that that lends itself to disruption, because, you know, by definition, you're not necessarily accepting, you're not necessarily buying anything that people are selling you. You're just like, you know, you have your own take.
I agree.
Yeah.
I said a moment ago about this idea of playing where no one else is playing. And one of the first accelerants of personal disruption in this framework is that a disruptor takes on market risk. So they, instead of taking on competitive risk, which would be everyone else is there, I'm going to go do that, I can scope it out really easily, you take on market risk, which is you don't know if there's a market.
Yes.
But if in fact there is,
yeah.
your odds of success are 6 times higher.
Yes.
And so to hear you say that, I would say your answer is yes. Mm-hmm. Introverts are uniquely suited to disruption because you're comfortable playing where other people aren't.
Yeah, and I don't even think you think about it in those terms. I think you just take it for granted mm-hmm. because that's just the way you live. And as I say, by definition, you've been living that way from the beginning because you've been in school cultures and then later in work cultures where your way of doing things and your way of being was not in keeping with the norm. So you always have a different track running in your mind mm-hmm. from the track that is being presented to you. And it's funny that you say all this, because with Quiet Revolution, when we first started the company, mm-hmm. Which is based around all these ideas, you know, we did the thing that I think all companies ask themselves when they're first starting, which is, okay, who are our competitors? Who are our role models here? And we kept scratching our heads. We couldn't really find one, because, you know, there's training companies, there's lifestyle brands, I suppose, but I don't think we're really either of those things.
So you yeah. continued to take on market risk.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
what would you say your company is? How do you describe it?
I mean, so the following thing, I guess, is becoming a kind of business cliche nowadays, but I really do think we are intensely mission driven. Mm-hmm. You know, our mission is to unlock the power of introverts for the benefit of us all, which is an important piece of it, because we really do think everybody benefits, you know, when you start using people's temperaments wisely. Mm-hmm. And right now we're really focused on making these things happen in workplaces and in schools, because the idea is those are the two places where the most humans spend the most amount of their time. Mm-hmm. So we want to transform those cultures and give the introverts and the extroverts the tools that they need to really shine in those cultures.
So you've built this community, you're building a company around the idea that we need to disrupt our view of introverts. Mm-hmm. Would you share an experience or two that you've had where you've seen that these ideas are working, or how it's made a difference as you've introduced them to a particular community, whether it's a school or a company? Can you think of one?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's so many. You know, like, I'm thinking of one company where, okay, one of the things we're doing now is we have a quiet ambassador experience. And so we go into companies and the companies identify a cohort of people who are passionate about these ideas, employees within the company. They serve as ambassadors, which means that we train them and coach them in our methodology and our thinking. And then they go and they take those ideas and implement them in their day-to-day life inside their companies and inside their teams. So it becomes this very cool thing. The idea is to help this mission grow organically. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking of one young woman in a company who became an ambassador. And she was quite introverted herself, but suddenly she had this role. And so she was going back to her team and saying, hey, guys, you know, maybe we should think differently about the way we structure our meetings. And maybe we should sit down and have a team meeting about the way that everybody likes to work differently and how we can accommodate each other's preferences. So not only did the team start to function better, but she herself came to be seen as a leader in a way that she hadn't been previously. So that was very cool to me.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then we've had schools, for example, really dramatically rethink how they do class participation. Because one of the most common problems that we hear is from parents who will say, you know, my child is doing great in school, they know everything, and they're being graded lower because they're not raising their hands as much as another child who actually is not as much in command of the material. It's very frustrating. So we've been working with schools, and some schools are starting to move towards a system of classroom, thinking about classroom engagement instead of classroom participation.
Mm.
So it's a much broader way of assessing how a student is interacting with material and peers.
So how are you defining the engagement?
Well, you know, it can be things like how
raising
your hand. Mm-hmm. That's the classic one. But it can also be, you know, are you chatting with fellow students after class about what just happened? Are you participating in writing? Are you showing the teacher, even through non-vocal signs, that you understand the material and that you're switched on? It's a more holistic way of thinking about the different ways people learn.
That would be fantastic. I have a daughter who is 16 and very much an introvert. And she said that frequently her teachers will say to her, you're doing really well in class. I wish you would speak up more.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yet she's very engaged.
Yes. Yeah.
She'll go talk to the teachers after class, have these, and she's engaged with her peers and the material. But as you say, the marker of engagement right now is, did you raise your hand?
Yeah, it's really frustrating. It's probably the most common comment that I get from parents of introverted kids is exactly what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it is true that we do want our kids to leave school with the skills that they need to make their voices heard. So I'm not saying that should be irrelevant, but we've gone so overboard. It's so lopsided right now in the way that we think about these things.
Well, and it also, I think, leads, I'm going to hypothesize for a minute and you can tell me if it's right or wrong, but I do think it leads to a situation where sometimes people interview for jobs and they get jobs they shouldn't get because they're just sort of good at talking. And people don't get jobs they should get because they're not so good at talking.
Oh my gosh, that happens all the time. And it's not just jobs, it's also startup pitches.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of a good friend of mine who's a very senior VC guy and private equity. And he's actually a very sharp guy and very attuned to these dynamics. And so he says he sees this happen all the time, that somebody will come in and they make a great presentation and everybody's impressed, even though they haven't really said anything. And I think most people are
give
not
them $500,000.
Yeah, exactly. But we really are trained that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Do you think it's possible for an extrovert to disrupt themselves and become an introvert?
Well, I don't think they're going to become an introvert, but I do think that for all of us, we want to disrupt ourselves by acquiring skills that are not necessarily in our, you know, default skill set. I a lot of extroverts come up to me and say, you know what, I would really like to be more comfortable with quiet and I'd like to be more comfortable with my own company. So how can I do that? And so, you know, I think extroverts need to stretch in those ways the same way introverts need to stretch at a cocktail party.
Mm-hmm.
And that all these things are acquirable. It's much more liberating to think of these things in terms of skills instead of in terms of basic personality. Mm-hmm. Because your personality is what it is and you should love it and accept it. And then layered on top of that, you can acquire any number of skills. And some of them will be uncomfortable for you to use, but you can use them strategically as long as you're honoring who you really are.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say if you're an extrovert who is not comfortable in your own company, you know, you can figure out little tricks and tweaks to make it work for you. But you should probably also schedule a dinner out with your friends for the night that, you know, if you know you're going to spend all day in your own company, mm-hmm. schedule the dinner out with friends afterwards mm-hmm. to reward yourself.
Reward yourself for doing something that was hard for you.
Yeah. And to come back to your basic default mode.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. You always wanted to be an author
mm-hmm.
from the time you were age 4.
Yeah.
But you didn't start your career as an author.
That is true. Very much not.
What was the path? What did you do?
Well, you know, for a million reasons, including the one that I share with many other people, I ended up graduating college and going to law school.
And what was the reason?
Well, I mean, okay, the reason that was more idiosyncratic was that I think there was some level on which I wanted to prove to myself that I could flourish in kind of a bolder, more alpha world than really came naturally to me. The reason I think I share in common with many people is, you know, I wanted to be able to support myself and it seemed like a solid way to do that. And once I got to law school, I think because it was such an unlikely place for me, I actually enjoyed it more than almost everyone I knew. Like, all my classmates hated law school, and I loved it. I really did. Yeah.
What did you love?
To me, it was just this great lark. Like, I couldn't even believe this whole thing existed. I don't know. I just found it intellectually fascinating. And
you love books, so you got to...
Yeah. I mean, most law students actually are introverted, mm-hmm. Probably way more than 50%. And... yeah, so I loved books. I loved the way of thinking that I was being trained in. Then I ended up practicing law on Wall Street for about 7 years before I left to become a writer. And for a lot of that time, I loved that too. You know, also because I was in this world of business, which was even less likely for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it fascinating to just learn all of that from scratch, you know. But I often liken it to the feeling of being in a foreign country.
Hmm.
So I think for many people, it's really enjoyable and exciting to be in a foreign country. And then comes the time that you're longing for home. And so that's how it was with me. Like, I had a few years where I really loved it. And then I just started itching for something else. But I didn't even know what the next thing was going to be. I ended up taking a leave of absence from my law firm after about 7 years, thinking that I was going to go travel or something. But literally it was like 1 or 2 days into the leave of absence, I suddenly found myself remembering that I had wanted to write. And
that's all it took. Just a little bit of decompression.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm telling you, before that I had spent like a year, 2, 3 years thinking, okay, what do I want to do next? This isn't right, but I can't figure out what the next thing should be. And it never was clear until I actually had the leave. Because I think what happens is, you know, when you're immersed in a career, it becomes such a socially hermetic bubble that you can't really see very far beyond it. So all I could really envision at that point was, well, maybe I'll leave my Wall Street firm and go take a job as an in-house counsel at a company where the hours aren't so bad. And I couldn't think more creatively than that.
Right. It's hard. And at some level, I mean, there's a lot of adrenaline I'm not trained as a lawyer, but I worked as a banker and an equity analyst on Wall Street. And there's a lot of adrenaline that comes from this kind of job.
Yes.
You feel kind of awesome.
That's so true. You feel alive. And I will say, I still say this to this day, I don't think I ever laughed as much as I did during those 7 years as a lawyer. And I think it's because, like, when it's that intense and you're working 17 hours a day, like, you get to that point where you're so punchy, yes. everything is hilarious, and you have all these colleagues around, and they've been through the same ridiculous uh-huh. scenario, uh-huh. you know? So it was really fun in some
yeah,
ways.
It is fun. So you took that leave of absence. Did you immediately become an author, or how did you make that transition?
Well, so I signed up for this class at NYU in creative nonfiction, mm-hmm. and I went to that class on the first day, and it really was like, you know, one of those cinematic epiphanies. I felt like, oh my gosh, this really is what I.
So, what would
need
the soundtrack
be
have been? What would the music have been?
I don't know, something very like, you know, thunderous and uplifting. yeah, I really felt like this is it. But I never imagined in my wildest dreams that I could actually make a living as a writer. So instead, I thought, okay, this is going to be my hobby, and now I have to figure out a way to support myself that will give me enough time to write. Mm-hmm. And so I sort of figured out this freelance consulting that I could do on the side, but I really thought of writing as my thing. Mm-hmm. And I did that for about 4 years before I started working.
Now, was it negotiation? Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So okay. I had done a lot of work studying how to negotiate, dating back to the time I was in law school. Mm-hmm. So I started training people in negotiation skills.
You created a diagnostic.
Yes.
I would like to put you on the spot a little bit. First of all, tell us about the diagnostic. And then I've taken the diagnostic, and I want to see if you can guess what I am.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I'll tell it. But what I'll do to make uh-huh. it easier is I'll tell you what I am, uh-huh. and then you can tell me if it's what you thought.
Okay. Sounds good, because I already have an idea.
Yeah.
Okay.
So tell all of us about the diagnostic, where people can go to take it, because I think it's fantastic.
Oh, thank you. Okay. So yes, we have this personality test that helps you understand where you fall on the introvert-extrovert spectrum. And there are lots of these tests out there, but well, first I'll say the way you can take ours is you go to our website, which is quietrev.com, and it's right up on the homepage. There are others of these tests out there, but the reason that we did our own is that the two, you know, based on all these years of research, it became clear that the two really important facets of introversion that people, I think, don't talk about enough. There's two. One is stimulation and one is deliberation. So stimulation is what we were talking about mm-hmm. earlier. Like, how do you just react to all the stuff that's coming at you day to day in your mm-hmm. environment? But there's also a quality of deliberation, which is, you know, when you're going to move forward and do something as a business person, especially, you're going to take a risk, you're going to take an action. Are you more the person who, you know, just do it, seize mm-hmm. the day, mm-hmm. or are you look before you leap? I'm going to think this through. I'm going to approach this very deliberately. And in general, introverts and extroverts really are quite different when it comes to that kind of risk taking. And it doesn't mean, by the way, that introverts don't take risks or that extroverts take them all. But it does mean that we approach risk taking pretty differently.
It's how you approach the risk.
It's how you approach it.
So it doesn't necessarily mean you're more of a risk taker or less of a risk taker. That's not what it's measuring.
I mean, it's a little bit of both. Uh-huh. There's a lot of data out there actually showing extroverts are more likely to get into car accidents. If you give them a financial risk, they're much more likely to take larger bets. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that extroverts are always doing that and right. introverts will never take a risk. You know, right. it's more subtle.
What you're saying, just to be very clear for our listeners then, is that there's the one scale of are you an introvert and extrovert? And then there's the other scale is do you analyze a lot and deliberate, or do you just start?
Well, I guess it's more, there's the scale of are you an introvert or an extrovert? And there's a number of different components mm-hmm. that help you know whether you're an introvert or an extrovert. And one of those components is how you react to stimulation.
Okay.
And the other is how much do you deliberate before taking an action or a risk?
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Good. Thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So people can go to your web page, quietrev.com, mm-hmm. and take it.
Yep.
Very cool. All right. So now I'm going to tell you what I am.
Okay.
And so on the introvert extrovert spectrum, if you have, I'm basically almost in the middle.
That's what I thought.
Slightly to introvert.
Yep, that's exactly what I thought. And by the way, I cannot always read people. Uh-huh. Even after all these years, I'm yeah. still fooled. I'm often fooled by people who are actually more introverted than I would have thought.
Oh, okay.
And that's because, you know, so many of us learn how to pass as being more extroverted.
Right. I bet, though, because we've had a couple of conversations just one-on-one,
yep,
you were probably able to diagnose it better.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. I've gotten to know you. Yeah. Exactly. But that's really exactly what I would have said.
Yeah. Okay.
And you know that, did I tell you there's a word for people who are kind of in the middle like you? And the word is ambivert.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. I'm pretty much an ambivert.
Yep.
Now on the, do you deliberate or do you analyze before you take action? Is that what it is?
Mm-hmm.
I'm off the charts on just go.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So interesting. In what way?
I think I am very much of the mindset of just, you know, minimum viable product here. Let's just take one action forward right now and just start seeing what we've got. It's not like jump in willy nilly, but like, let's just start to do something today.
Yeah.
Analyzing it too much, I get paralyzed by the analysis. And so I prefer to just start.
So does that mean you actually would analyze, but you've kind of learned through experience about the paralysis problem?
Or do you just instinctively, that's actually a really good question. It could be because I tend to be a perfectionist. Mm-hmm. And so maybe, oh, how fascinating. It might be a coping mechanism for perfectionism of just start.
Yeah. Yeah, no, a lot of introverts tend towards perfectionism.
Huh.
Yeah, it's a really common liability.
Fascinating. We're going to play a game.
Okay.
So this is a game that David Klatt, my producer, came up with. I have not seen these questions.
Okay.
And kind of like rapid fire, we just have to answer the questions.
Okay.
Susan, what country have you been to that you think I haven't been to?
I'm going to Portugal this summer, and I'm going to guess you haven't been to Portugal.
I haven't been to Portugal.
Okay.
Colombia.
You're right. So I have to say, my husband loves Cartagena. Like, he really loves it. So it's high on our list to go there.
It's beautiful. It okay. All right. Your turn.
What's one book you read at a young age that you still think about?
Oh. A Wrinkle in Time.
Ah, I was thinking of that. That's so funny.
What's yours?
Well, I really was thinking.
Oh, okay.
A Wrinkle in Time. And my son just asked me what A Wrinkle in Time is, in fact. I was like, huh.
Okay, I'm fist bumping you.
But I'm not sure I fist can bump. Tell you.
Okay. Which of your family members do you think of when you hear the word disruptor?
I would say my husband, because my husband, even more than the way I was describing myself,
even more so,
would really does his own thing.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. And he has a very strong personality to go with that quality.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, between the two, that can have an outsized impact.
Oh, right, right. Yeah. It gets magnified. My mom, actually, because my mom grew up in rural Arizona, very, very, very small town. She graduated from high school in 1955, and she left the state to go to college. Not only to go to college, but she went to college out of state.
Wow.
That's disruptive.
Very brave.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you find your current work challenging?
Yes. And I love it. What about you?
Yeah, absolutely. Same. Yeah.
I can't believe how much I love my work.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I really feel that way.
What did your best boss offer you that no one else has matched?
I think really believing that I had capabilities that I did not know that I had. I'm thinking of somebody I worked with back when I was a lawyer.
Do you want to say their name? Give him a shout out?
Yeah, I'll do that. His name is Peter Darrow. So if you're out there listening, Peter, I always felt that about him. He always had these grand visions of my capabilities. And I'd be like, really?
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to say something similar. I had a boss, Michael Brown, when I was working at Merrill Lynch. And he's the first boss I thought he saw something in me. Like, I could be much bigger and better than it's almost like my world went from sort of this very small myopic view to like, wow, I could do these things.
Hmm.
And I was already at least 10, 12 years into my career.
Wow. Mm. Wow.
Mm-hmm. It took a while. I'm definitely a late bloomer. Okay. Your turn.
Which celebrity do you get mistaken for? This actually happens to me, not mistaken, but people tell me all the time that I remind them of the hippie character in Friends. The Lisa Kudrow one.
Really?
Yes.
I can see that. I can see that. More the looks than the personality.
Well, I hear
both.
The looks and the sound of my voice is what I hear. And I see your producer, David, is nodding his head very emphatically.
Well, there you go. It's been corroborated. I have been told that I look... But I've been told that I look like Hugh Grant.
What?
I mean, like his sister, not him. I don't know. Maybe a leap, but that's what I've been told. Yeah, I don't see it either.
I guess I can vaguely see it. Yeah. I don't know. It would not have come to mind.
No.
Okay. What's one thing people get wrong about you? I don't know.
I do.
What's yours?
No, I know what they get wrong about you.
Oh, what?
Well, you said that people see you only through the lens of being an introvert.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
And that's not the sum total of who you are.
Right, right.
Something that people get wrong about me. Okay, I'm going to say this. People think I'm really, really serious, and I am serious, but I'm not always serious. Mm-hmm. I think they sometimes get that wrong. What are you going to do to disrupt yourself in 2017?
I guess I alluded to it before, but I'm really starting to get back into writing now. You know, so Quiet came out in 2012, and I had initially thought I was going to go start writing another book right away, but the kind of the call of the Quiet Revolution was so compelling that I really stopped writing. And now I'm easing back into it, and it feels really good.
So you've started to write this next book?
I've started to research it.
You've started to research?
I haven't started writing really yet.
Okay.
Yeah, because my process is that, like, I have an idea, and then I like to walk around the world for a year or two, just seeing everything through the lens of that idea. So lots of interviews, and I read a ton, and do all kinds of research.
So you're in the middle of that process?
So I'm in the middle of that process, which is so much fun. You know, I take all my notes and stick them in a document, and then I have a document that's like thousands of pages long at the end, and I have to figure out what to do with it.
Oh, I'm so excited. Yeah. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, that's really great. And that's a great, so you're going to disrupt yourself by moving back into writer mode.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, while also, you know, continuing to build out the Quiet Revolution. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hmm. How about you?
I have the manuscript for my next book, which is due in May of this year.
May of this year? Wait, that's in like 2 months. Mm-hmm. Wow.
I think I write a little bit differently than you do.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I've been working on it, but I think I have a different writing process than you do. But here's the thing. Unlike you, I've never thought of myself as a writer. So we write for different reasons.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. You're a writer, and you and I write more to get an idea across. And so my process is it's just different.
Yeah. No, that makes total sense to me. Yeah.
Well, thank you again. And it's been wonderful. Super. And like I said, I'm super excited for your next book. And I'll look forward to following up with you in 6 or 9 months to see how your book's coming.
That sounds great. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
Susan Cain made me think of 3 things that are important for us to remember when we think about disruption. The first takeaway provides a nice reminder of the first accelerant of personal disruption. You have to weigh whether you're going to take on market or competitive risk. When Susan listens to her own drummer as a child, writes about things that make her readers vaguely uncomfortable, and starts a business that doesn't have any clear competitors, she's taking on market risk and exploring new territory. She risked the fact that she didn't know if anyone else would eventually play along, but she followed her idea confidently. If you take a similar risk, playing where others aren't, the odds of success are 6 times higher and the revenue opportunity 20 times greater. The second takeaway has to do with what we should think about when we're trying to find the right curve. Early in life, there's this tendency to think we need to find the perfect career, the perfect partner, the perfect curve. But you don't. Going to law school and practicing law on Wall Street may have involved a teeny bit of avoidance, as Susan shared, but they felt like the right curve at the time. In fact, she really enjoyed them. If you aren't sure what you want to do, always take the opportunity or the learning curve that will eventually open the most doors, trusting that over time you will discover your way to better and better curves. The third takeaway
is that Susan's story shows us how important it is to take a step back to grow. Susan had worked as a lawyer in Wall Street, or on Wall Street, I should say, for 7 years. She'd felt for a couple of years it was time to consider something else, but she hadn't come up with anything very creative. The scope of her choices was small, incremental. She says when you become immersed in a career, it is a socially hermetic bubble. It becomes difficult to see very far beyond it. So she took a leave of absence. She signed up for a class. Almost immediately, she knew it was time to really be a writer. What would have happened if she hadn't stopped to reflect? Would Quiet have been written? What won't happen if you don't step back? As you look to disrupt, play where no one else is playing. And if you're an introvert, it may be a bit easier. Recognize that no S-curve is ever wasted. Every S-curve is useful. And remember to take a break, to pause. Your future self will thank you. If you'd like to look at this interview in greater depth, you can download the transcript on my website at whitneyjohnson.com. Thank you to those of you who are writing in. Brandy Whitson wrote, I just listened to your podcast for the first time, specifically Patrick Pichette, episode 8, life-changing. Thank you. If you enjoy the Disrupt Yourself podcast, leave us a review on iTunes. It really is one of the best ways for new listeners to find the podcast. Thanks for listening. Finally, thank you again to Susan for being our guest, to our producer David Klatt, editor Heather Hunt, and art director Brandon Jameson. I'm Whitney Johnson, and this is Disrupt Yourself.